I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In his new book, Repeopling Vermont, historian Paul Searles says the story of Vermont in the 20th century is one of fundamental contradictions and ironies. These contradictions and ironies center around the pervasive idea that Vermont's strongest asset is its rural character and values, and yet its greatest challenge or problem is its lack of development and population. Whether or not those two things are totally at odds with one another or just sometimes in conflict has been an ongoing source of debate, frustration, and opportunity for the state and its leaders for over the last, 200 years or so. Searles explores these big ideas by focusing on one town, Landgrove, and two different stories centered in this part of the state in different eras. Paul Searles joins us now to talk about these stories and what they reveal about Vermont even today. Professor Searles, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why Landgrove?
Well, because I became interested in the Swedish recruitment program, which occurred in 1890 when about 55 Swedes were brought over and settled. They were divided into three different colonies, and one of the colonies was supposedly the Weston Colony, but they were actually dropped down into Landgrove, the town south of that, where they went to work up on Mount Peru in a charcoal operation.
Despite my surname, I was not part of the Swedish settlement program, and I had never heard about it until your book. So describe what it was and this sort of larger-than-life character, Major Alonzo Valentine, who really conceived of the idea.
Yeah, so Valentine was the operator, the owner of a knitting mill in Bennington, and he was appointed in 1888 to this new position, which was Commissioner of Agriculture. And he was just given the task of accumulating statistical information and then giving advice about potential solutions to the problems that were plaguing the decline of rural Vermont. And instead of doing what the legislature told him to do, what his mandate was, he instead launched into this insane program that he was the theoretical salvation of rural Vermont, if it indeed was in need of salvation, was the recruitment of Swedes. And he actually carried it through.
He was just supposed to come up with ideas.
He just come up with ideas.
And instead, he recruited somebody else to help recruit Swedes to come to Vermont to repopulate the state.
To repopulate the state. Now, the thing about it is that at the time, you have to think both in terms of the physical landscape and the human landscape. And those two themes, as your introduction made clear, run all the way up to the present. And the problem at the time in the Gilded Age, the 1880s, was that there was a strong belief among state leaders that there was something seriously wrong with the rural human landscape. The people were dissipated Yankees, or even worse, they were French Canadians. And so what he thought he would do is replace those people with Swedes who are, you know, tall and Protestant and have blonde hair, and they would be wonderful replacements. And then if you replace the people, the human landscape, then what would happen was the physical landscape would improve. And by the definition at the time, that meant making it more prosperous, more modern.
Yeah, I mean, you write that in 1850, I think you said 40% of the native-born population was living outside of the state. And Vermonters today are very familiar with this problem or challenge, depending on how you want to look at it, that people who have the means to leave the state often do. They find better opportunities elsewhere. And you write that in the post-Civil War era and even before that, this was seen as a problem not just because there weren't enough people, but there was this idea that the people who were left behind were not of good quality. And yes, as you dance around the edges of this idea with the Swedes, they were tall, they were blonde, they were white, mm-hmm. and they were not French Canadian, and they were not Irish. So this was very much in some ways ethnically and racially motivated, in addition to being seen as a solution to just a problem of numbers, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Why did we think in the 1880s that we needed more people in Vermont?
Well, it was pretty much the biggest cause of concern for the state's leaders was the decline of rural Vermont. I mean, the numbers began to go down in different places in the southern part of the state by the 1830s. The state's population as a whole remained about the same for about 130 years. The big towns got bigger and the small towns got smaller. And there was this great concern and fear that these small towns were broken, that they were full of people who were degenerate, who all the people with ambition and intelligence had left, and that all was left behind was the leftovers.
And so what happened with this Swedish recruitment program?
So the 55 Swedes came. Valentine divided them into three different colonies. He dropped one of those colonies down in Landgrove. This program was a huge controversy in the state at the time. When I wrote my previous book, I gave this story about three sentences. But in 1890, it's the only thing people could talk about. And there were a lot of people who objected to the program strenuously. They couldn't figure out on a number of levels, but one of the main things is, why are we giving farms to Swedes when we have lots of young boys who are native born who can't afford them? And so in the 1890s,
and they would pay for the Swedes to come over,
they
right? They would pay
for the
passage.
And the promise was that each one would get $25 and a cow. And I don't know if they actually ended up getting the $25 and a cow, but that was what they were promised. The 1890 legislature, which was, of course, the House was dominated by people from small towns, generally speaking, rural people thought the program was stupid, and they discontinued it, and everyone in the state agreed to never talk about it again.
That's why I didn't hear about it.
It's true, but the big thing about what the program did was it was such a news of the weird story that Vermont's going to regenerate its rural parts with Swedes that the story went out all around the country. And so people in New York Times, Chicago, San Francisco reported on it continuously for a year and a half. And the message that got out was that you can have Vermont farms cheaply, that Vermont farms are cheap. And maybe Valentine was like this great genius and he only used the Swedes as a gimmick, but he drew together the first ever comprehensive list of farms for sale, and he established contacts in many small towns that he could forward the many letters he was receiving inquiring from Americans inquiring about farms. And that helped to set off the enormous tourism boom of the 1890s.
We're talking with Paul Searles. We're talking about his book, which is called Repeopling Vermont. But we're also looking at these broad questions that have plagued Vermont, have challenged Vermont for many, many generations. This question of tradition, values, pastoral landscape, in sometimes in opposition to questions about development, welcoming other people. What do we want this state to look like and how can we thrive? These are questions that Vermonters have been asking one another and grappling with for decades, centuries even. And Paul Searles in his book really takes these two stories, one we're talking about now with this resettlement of Swedish families, to trace how this has happened through the course of Vermont and some big ideas that we still think about. Professor Searles, I want to talk about that tourism boom and how this news story sort of helped lead other Americans to come and buy up Vermont. But one of the things that I can't help but notice that sounds so similar to today with this Swedish repopulation story is this idea that we would import people from other places who the royal we, the people in power in Vermont, deemed appropriate. And pay them to come, give them an incentive. Sounds a lot like what we've been doing in the last year or so, suggesting that people who might be able to come to Vermont with a telecommuting job could get $10,000. I mean, do mm-hmm. you see those parallels?
Yeah, I do see that parallel. But it's a theme that runs all the way through Vermont's history over the last 120 years, which is the engineering of the human landscape. And so when Valentine's commission was discontinued, the list of farms for sale that he'd drawn together was given to the Board of Agriculture. And for about 20 years, the Board of Agriculture was responsible for promoting tourism. And in 1911, the state shifted that responsibility to something called the Bureau of Publicity, which is the first ever state agency responsible for that job. And through the 19-teens, 1920s, what you see is the Board of Publicity, Bureau of Publicity, was selling the physical landscape. It was selling Vermont as unspoiled and the Switzerland of America and vacation land. And the strategy was to attract a very small number of elite people because the concern was that Vermont would become too built up, too overdeveloped, and lose its attraction. And so what they were really concerned about was preserving the physical landscape as a means to engineer the human landscape, much as Alonzo Valentine would have done in 1890 or people are trying to do now.
Yeah, and people are still trying to do it now, but it doesn't seem like it was entirely successful, although somewhat. We've seen a lot of people, as you mentioned, even people back then buying these, what Alonzo Valentine incorrectly called abandoned farms, but buying this land cheaply because they had the money and turning them into second homes.
So there's something very callous, I think, about the Bureau of Publicity. It struck me when I was doing the research, which is that the leaders of the Bureau would say, well, we did a study in 1928, and in 1908, there were only 6 farms available in these 4 towns, but now there's 30 of our farms available in these towns. And isn't that wonderful? And the answer is, well, no. I mean, first of all, it's a tragedy for the people who lose their farms. And second, the attraction, what you're selling, is the grazing landscape. It's the pastoral landscape. And the more farms that are converted from a working landscape to a recreational landscape, you compromise the scenery.
And as you write in your book, these farms weren't abandoned to begin with. They were in use in the agricultural landscape. Perhaps some of the buildings, if a farm had consolidated, there might have been 2 homes and only one family was living on the farm, so one home might not be used. But a lot of this land was grazing land. It was still working farmland. And this idea of abandoned farms really became part of the zeitgeist, and it was a phrase that then kept being used. And still today, I think we think of not abandoned farms, but farm consolidation certainly as a big sadness in Vermont, which it can be, but not always.
Yes. And Alonzo Valentine really pioneered the use of the phrase abandoned, and he received a lot of criticism. People said, you're giving the state a real black eye. It sounds like it's just this horrible, desolate place. But I mean, the message was that Vermont farms can be had cheap, that people had just walked away without locking the front door as they made their way to the Midwest. And people continue to talk about abandoned farms all the way. It really sort of dies out to some extent in the 1930s. There were certainly plenty of people who said, that's ridiculous. There's consolidated farms, there's farms for sale, there's no abandoned farms. So it gets into when you get to the 1930s, which is where the other thread of my story picks up, increasingly what happens is that there comes to be this idea much more about a Vermont way of life, as opposed to just the physical landscape. There's a beautiful landscape, beautiful scenery, but also small towns and civic engagement and really strong communities. And the state, by then the publicity service under the watch of the Development Commission, was constantly selling the Vermont way of life, strong communities. This was one of the underpinnings of the Vermont Life magazine, founded in 1947 by Sam Ogden, who's in my story. The problem is that if you're trying to sell strong communities are dependent on persistence. It's fine for new people to move into towns, but communities accrue over a long period of time. They're like coral reefs, and you need to have multi-generational persistence among families in order to make communities strong. If you replace all the people in a town, there's people there, but it's not a strong community. But using strong communities as a means to get people to buy homes in Vermont is paradoxical in itself.
And still, again, something we talk about today in this question of whether we should suggest to ourselves and to outsiders that Vermont is in a very strong place. It's wonderful. It's beautiful versus we have not enough economic development. We have not enough manufacturing. We have not enough jobs is something that comes up in every single gubernatorial cycle. It's something we still struggle with today. Matthew wrote on our Facebook page, more business friendly equals more immigrants. Choose your poison. Some people are talking a little bit about how development regulations like Act 250 have led to the way Vermont is today, for better or for worse. Scott says Act 250 must be scrapped, start over, just adopt New Hampshire's ways. They rock and business is booming. Paul on Facebook says, be done with Act 250 and allow counties and communities to determine their growth and development with some state standards for waterways and fragile ecosystems. If you want to remain rural, then restrict growth. If you want to employ your citizens, then allow them to have a hand in developing these business ideas. The one-size-fits-all approach of Act 250 is suffocating our economic opportunities. Professor Searles, we're not going to let this get hijacked by Act 250, which is another serious topic of conversation that we've had many times on this show today. But you do tie it into the book. But let's start with this question of Sam Ogden. We're still in Landgrove, interestingly, but post-Depression era. What's happening here and how does Sam Ogden fit into this story of preserving Vermont versus development?
So Sam Ogden arrived in Landgrove by chance in 1929 and desperately wanted to change his life. He lived in New York City and he worked in the insurance industry and he hated it. He thought it was incredibly dehumanizing. He wanted to live a self-directed life. And when he arrived in Landgrove, it was a poor town. And in the village of Landgrove,
the Swedes didn't make it prosperous?
So they did not actually. Yes, the engineering of the human landscape did not result in Landgrove becoming a big town. It was everything that Sam Ogden wanted. He bought up all the houses in the village and saw that this would be a place that he could fix up and turn into an artist colony, into a summer colony. And very quickly, he was very successful with that. And from the beginning, one of the things that he really emphasized was that he loved the people who lived there, the people who were there when he arrived. Most of them were delinquent taxpayers or whatever, but he thought that they were real people living real lives. And that's what he wanted. If you want to eat, you grow your own food. If you don't have the tools that you need, you make them. If you want a good school, you get involved in the school. And most of all, if you want good politics, of course, the magic of a small town and Vermont's traditions of local control is that you can get involved in politics really quickly, which he did, getting himself elected to the state legislature in 1934 and becoming a very important person in the legislature very quickly.
Okay, so he wanted to have a community where you have these strong people who have roots in the community, who are hard scrabble. It sounds a lot like what we sometimes hear today with people who come from other places, other parts of Vermont even sometimes, and want to live in a pastoral landscape but don't always want to live where a farm might smell. But then he bought up all the buildings.
And so he arrived in 1930 is when he really set out on this. And in 1950, there was this article in this magazine called Craft Horizons, which talked about how wonderful Sam was. He had a forge. He used to do ironwork. And it had a picture of these people and who were longtime residents and called them the last of the old timers. And that was the thing, is what had happened over the course of that 20 years is that Sam Ogden loved the people who were there when he arrived. He wanted his friends who were puppeteers and artists and musicians to take part in this experience, and he wanted the town to stay the same size. And something has to give. And what gave was that the people who had been there when he arrived were generally forced out, and each people who abandoned, who couldn't afford to live there anymore, he would buy up their house and he would sell it to some musician from New York City as a summer home.
Right. So he wants to preserve this landscape, but in trying to preserve it, he makes it unavailable and inaccessible for the people that he professed to love for living there.
It's nothing he would have said he intentionally wanted to do. He's not a villain by any means, but the Vermont way of life, as he and many other people back then saw it, is utterly dependent on it remaining on a small scale. And that's what differentiated it from other places, particularly in terms of civic engagement. The magic of a small town is that everyone needs to get involved in governance. The problem, though, Sam Ogden, then he was a big conservationist. He founded the Water Resources Board. He fought for 30 years, was the leader in fighting billboards, and he finally got what he wanted there. He was big into forestry control. And the problem that him and many other people discovered over the course of the 20th century, which is really the central paradox, although there's – it being Vermont, there's a million paradoxes and dilemmas, you know. But the central paradox that Sam Ogden and many others like him discovered was that – keeping Vermont looking natural takes a lot of work. That's the problem, is that we want it to look natural. In order to do that, you have to build bureaucracies and empower experts in order to manage growth. And so keeping something natural requiring growth means that you – managing growth means that you need to make sacrifices in other ways. No one loved the small town character of Vermont more than Sam Ogden. And he thought that the one town, one vote – apportionment of the House was the best thing that had ever happened to Vermont. And as long as it was one town, one vote, he couldn't get through the large-scale land use commission that he really wanted. He thought Vermont should have a statewide land use laws, and rural legislatures weren't going for that. And so finally, when the legislature was reapportioned in 1965, he was able to get the land use law, Act 250, that he wanted, yet he still thought that the reapportionment legislature was the worst thing that had ever happened to Vermont. And that's kind of the problem. I mean, the problem of Vermont in the 20th century is not a conflict between different kinds of people. It's a conflict within people, within each of us.
But you describe Act 250 sometimes as the punchline of these tensions. What do you mean?
It's because the punchline is that over the course of the 20th century, what happened was that people in positions of power in Vermont threw their eggs into the basket of tourism and having a particular Vermont way of life. It seemed clear that dairy farming was on the decline. Extractive industries like lumber, quarrying were on the decline. Small-scale manufacturing was on the decline. Recreation, tourism had the greatest potential for growth. And in order to do that, in order to make that a focus of the state's efforts to develop, it means that you need to actually make sacrifices in how much development you can actually have. And so you're trapped in between wanting to stimulate the state's economy and trying to make it sure that it looks like the state's economy has not been stimulated at all.
Boy, so many connections still to today that we can tease out. I mean, even Sam Ogden, being one of the founders of Vermont Life magazine, Vermont Life really struggled in its last few years to try to present a picture of Vermont that was accurate and that included other people versus readers who said, I want the pastoral stuff. Give me the farms. Give me the landscapes. Paul Searles, you are actually going around the state talking about these things with other people around libraries. You're having these conversations, not just about the book, but about how these tendrils come into the modern life and people can still get you to their library?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to come down. The Department of Libraries has partnered with the Vermont Historical Society under a grant from the Humanities Council. And they have a packet of books that can be sent to any library in the state. And I would be delighted. I spent 8 years on this book. I'd be happy to drive down to your library or your local historical society and discuss the book with you. There's also a packet, which is available online, of discussion questions that you can download in advance of my appearance.
The book is called Repeopling Vermont, The Paradox of Development in the 20th Century. And we have a link to library talks that have already been scheduled at vpr.org. Paul Searles, thank you very much for having this conversation with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Vermont Edition.